Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our third session of our 2019 Becoming Buddha Immersion in the Dhamma Spring Retreat on May 18th, 2019. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Satipatthana Sutta. In this primary sutta, the Buddha establishes the four foundations of mindfulness as the meditation method for deepening jhana, or concentration, and then how to apply a well-concentrated mind to establish and maintain mindfulness of the various themes of the Dhamma. Information on our retreats is available at becoming-buddha.com, and if you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
I guess you could call meditation and mindfulness the central theme of the Dhamma. So we're going to talk about the Satipatthana Sutta, the Sutta on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. We're not going to talk about it, I'm going to teach it. But just as a way of introducing this talk, we learned of the confusion that the Buddha went to recognize and worked himself through in the Nagara Sutta, coming to his awakening, that confused state that he had developed in his own mind, the distracted state of the feedback loop that he talked about. And then he described how it came to be. From ignorance came fabrications. A mind rooted in fabrications is constantly fabricating, meaning it's constantly creating views of itself in its own mind. And I got into depth about that, how we create an imaginary existence, even though it seems like we're living in reality. In fact, we're living in this imagined state that we've created in our own mind. And that's the constant distraction. Many people call it today monkey mind. Most people come to meditation because they feel they just can't quiet their mind down. And that's the problem. And so the counter to a mind that is constantly distracted wouldn't be effective to learn visualization or chanting or bowing or appeasing gods or praying or anything else to solve the problem of distraction. The solution to the problem of distraction is
concentration.
So the Buddha taught a concentration practice, period, and nothing else. And we're going to get into this a little bit more about how other things develop. Most schools will tell you that the Buddha taught dozens, if not hundreds, of different meditation techniques. And that's a misunderstanding and a misapplication of the Satipatthana and the Anapanasati Sutta and many others. It's just taking license, making a meditation practice out of something that we'd like to be a meditation practice when in fact it isn't. Contemplation isn't meditation, is it? Contemplation is contemplation. It's thinking. You might do it in a structured way and you might be quiet and you might have, I don't know, some incense going and a candle burning, but it's still just thinking. And if that thinking is rooted in ignorance, you can contemplate all you want, but all you're going to contemplate is you're going to contemplate yourself into becoming further ignorant. The Buddha taught meditation for the sole purpose of deepening jhana, J-H-A-N-A. And that's what jhana means. Jhana means concentration or a non-distracted state. So he taught this method that I now call, and some people call, shamatha vipassana meditation. The Buddha never called it that. I can't find a reference to meditation that has the word samatha as the Pali word or shamatha, the Sanskrit word. I don't know that I've ever, now that I'm thinking about it, I don't know if I've ever read it in the Pali canon. Vipassana is there because it was the old Pali word that means insight. So insight is important. But as a technique, the Buddha taught the shamatha vipassana technique in many suttas, including the Yoganatha Sutta that's in the book. The Simsapa Sutta is another one that references it. And what that means is that shamatha vipassana, both aspects of quieting the mind for gaining insight, both of those aspects are a meditation practice. Not one and not the other. The Buddha taught, and if you read it in the Yoganatha Sutta and others, he taught shamatha vipassana meditation in tandem, meaning both of them are required to be together. And I'm making that point because the vipassana movement puts most of its emphasis on insight, and after the initial foray into calming the mind, somewhat dismisses that. Where the Buddha teaches that both of those components are part of a meditation practice, and meditation is not for seeking insight. This is another difference or contradiction between what the Buddha taught and the modern insight movement. Insight is not something that we hope to develop in meditation. From a well-concentrated mind and framed by the entire Eightfold Path, meaning the refined mindfulness that we're going to learn how to do in just a moment, out of that refined mindfulness, we gain insight. So we don't go into meditation looking for insight. It doesn't mean that insight might not arise, but we can often become distracted by that. It's by living our life moment by moment within the framework of the Eightfold Path that we gain true and useful insight into the only insight that the Buddha was interested in, the three marks of existence and nothing else. Because the problem of ignorance and fabricated thinking is represented as those three marks of existence. So, clear on that?
Yes.
We meditate for concentration, and that's the reason why we don't do it for other things. There's no other benefit as far as a Dhamma is concerned. That is, I started out with transcendental meditation. As a worldwide movement, that's probably the largest single meditative movement around. And it worked well for me for a couple of years until I got to the point where it just left me wanting more, and there didn't seem to be anything in the structure of TM that could actually give that to me. I knew a lot of the people in TM. I still know quite a few of them. And so I knew what practices they were developed. And what they were doing didn't seem to me to be that worthwhile to developing my own understanding. Plus, I saw some insincerity in the way it was presented. Plus, it was also very expensive. Mm-hmm. And that's something that even way back then, this is, how old am I? 33, 35 years ago. It was $1,200 back then. I think it's $1,600 or $1,800 now. Which is fine. You can charge whatever you want. But even my teacher back then was making excuses for how expensive it was. And then I learned that technique, and about a year later, and I'm learning, I'm starting to build up my network within the TM community and learning about these other things, and all very excited. And then I was told that if I wanted to go to the next level, it's called city training, SIDDHI, that I needed to have $3,000 in my pocket, which I didn't have. And it was very disappointing because I really felt that at first, before I thought about it, that I'm not going to be able to so-called awaken in this lifetime because I can't afford it. That's an awful thought for any human being to have, isn't it? And yet it was, I don't want to sound like I'm trying to beat them up, but that was how it was presented. If you want to learn this most important, what you learn is okay. But if you really want to get it, please write us another check. It just didn't seem right to me. And I learned some other things about it. I'm not putting it down. It's still a useful movement. Many people gain a measure of calm and peace. It's just not what the Buddha taught. And I'm just using that as an example. There was nothing of what I'm about to read in that meditation method or any other method. I've learned hundreds of different methods. And none of them had any of this foundation in it, and none of them helped develop concentration. On one occasion, the Buddha was in Kamasadama when he addressed those assembled. Friends, there are four frames of reference, four foundations of mindfulness that are required for the purification of all beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and regret, for the disappearance of pain and distress, for the establishing the right method of practice. If I ask you a question, would you like to overcome sorrow and regret? Would you like to have the disappearance of pain and distress? Would you like to establish the right method of practice? Would any of you say yes to that?
Yes.
And for complete unbinding, does that sound good?
Yep.
What are these four? These four foundations of mindfulness. Again, this is one of those suttas where you can see the whole Dhamma in the sutta. And this is particularly significant in that way, where the Buddha first teaches us how to develop a well-concentrated mind that supports the refined mindfulness. And then the rest of the sutta, he says, and apply that well-concentrated, refined mindfulness in this manner. And that's where different meditation methods have developed from missing that teaching. Being mindful, what are these for? Being mindful of feelings arising. Maybe I missed a section. Sorry. Being mindful of the breath in the body. This is just how we begin a meditation practice, isn't it? Every time. We are establishing that first foundation of mindfulness, being mindful of the breath in the body. Being mindful of the breath in the body, determined and alert, and abandoning craving and aversion to what is occurring. That's one instruction, by the way. Becoming mindful of the breath in the body while abandoning craving and craving and aversion for what is occurring. It's simply a way of saying becoming quiet in our mind, establishing that well-concentrated mind and the beginning of refined mindfulness. I'm no longer craving, I'm no longer averse. And for most of us, that is just in that one breath, isn't it? And then we have a thought or a feeling, and we're craving, and we have aversion again, or some manifestation of that, right? And so what does the Buddha tell us to do? He doesn't tell us that all is lost because you can't meditate. He says, just do it again. Just take another breath. Take an in-breath and an out-breath, be mindful of it, and you're meditating. And every time you do that, every time you find this, this is why I said before to John earlier, and to all of us, I've said it so many times, meditation is not just being mindful of the breath in the body. If it was, there'd only be one foundation of mindfulness, wouldn't there be? But the Buddha understood that we need four foundations. Because once we become mindful of the breath in the body, most of us, we're going to have one or two or maybe three breaths, maybe four, and then something's going to get our attention. We are now distracted. And we are distracted by a feeling or a thought or a combination of the two. And so, rather than having one foundation of mindfulness, the Buddha taught these four. The next one is, being mindful of feelings arising from the sixth sense base, determined and alert and abandoning craving and aversion for what is occurring. So first, I became mindful of my breath, and I'm reminded that now that I'm mindful of my breath, wait a minute, I still want something new? What's the instruction? What did I just get? Wait a minute, come back to the sensation of breathing. Now I'm meditating correctly. And so I'm a well-accomplished meditator now. I learned what to do. Uh-oh, now there's a feeling. That guy to cut me off, I wish I would have said this to him, whatever it might be. Or I hope they got the bibimbap again at dinner tonight. It's all a distraction, it's a feeling. What do we do with it? Be mindful that it's craving and aversion that is bringing this to the fore in my mind, and I come back to the sensation of breathing. Being mindful of thoughts arising from the sixth sense base, determined and alert, and abandoning craving and aversion to what is occurring. It happens to everyone in meditation, doesn't it? First, we become mindful of the breath, and no matter how well concentrated it is, it might take some meditators a half an hour to become distracted again, but it'll happen. And what do? We come back to the sensation of breathing. Those are the first three foundations of mindfulness. The fourth foundation, and it reflected in that last instruction that I gave when we come out of meditation, notice the quality of your mind, be at peace with your mind. That relates to this fourth foundation of mindfulness. Being mindful of the present quality of mind, determined and alert, and abandoning craving and aversion with what is occurring. So if I find myself in a mind that is distressed, how do I apply this teaching? I don't insist that me in this moment be any different than I am. Why? Because I can't. That's just common sense. And it simply means that my mind is distressed. So what? I take another breath and it's not. And if I take another breath and I still find myself in distress, should I take that personally? Does it make sense to take it personally? Does it make sense to say how stupid I am, or you can't meditate? Everybody else in the world can meditate. That old Siddhartha G, he could do it, but you can't. It just means come back to the sensation of breathing. Now we have established the four foundations of mindfulness. We have set the foundation for all Dhamma practice. And think about when we take these foundations of mindfulness deeper into the Dhamma, how we learned about dependent origination, and how when we react to feelings, we're furthering our becoming further ignorant. But we've also been given this technique called Shamatha Vipassana meditation to interrupt it at the point that it's occurring. That's why I said earlier, meditation, the practice of meditation is a direct engagement with the Dhamma as the Dhamma is unfolding. It happens within our meditation practice through these four foundations of mindfulness. Am I clear on that?
Yes.
So the breath is nothing to take personally. Most people don't, but people that have had severe trauma have initial difficulty just breathing. And if anybody of you has that and you don't want to talk about it here, just talk to me later. It's just not worth going into that right now. And then this process in meditation, establishing seclusion, teaching myself that I don't have to react to feelings. I can just stay calm. When I'm done with my meditation session and I get off my cushion and go out into the world and something occurs, I now have the presence of mind. My mind is now well secluded. Right? Seclusion is both on our cushion and off our cushion to not react to what's occurring. I can stay present. And it's just that practical. That's why we use meditation to deepen concentration. The next section of this Satipatthana Sutta is called Mindfulness of the Breath in the Body. And how does one remain mindful of the breath in the body in and of itself? And that line, in and of itself, means simply without distraction, without going into something else. Which is also a teaching on not analyzing it. If I find myself not able to breathe, what should I analyze? What should I figure out? Where's the problem? Find a secluded spot. Find the shade of a tree or an empty hut. That's when the Buddha, I mentioned yesterday, I never found anywhere where the Buddha said you should meditate for 1 hour and a length of time. I never read it anywhere. What the Buddha said was go find the root of a tree or an empty hut. That means it's time to go meditate. Go find a secluded spot where you're less likely to be distracted. And he would say, and do jhana. Meaning, the meditation, the Buddha always referred to meditation as doing jhana, meaning we meditate to deepen concentration. The Buddha continues, sitting erect with legs crossed in front, that's only because that was common at the time. People hear that and say, oh, I have to sit on the floor. You don't have to. Placing attention on the breath. How do we learn how to be mindful of the breath in the body? Again, it's incredibly practical, isn't it? And pretty obvious for most people, but not all of us. Be mindful of the breath. Remaining mindful of the breath, breathe in and breathe out. Excuse me. Notice there's no instruction for how to breathe out or how to breathe in. The Buddha's not saying take a real long breath and then take a couple of short breaths and then take another long. I mean, I've been taught practices like that, always manipulating the breath as some form of mindfulness. Again, the Buddha never taught it. It's just distracting. However our breath is presenting itself to us in the moment, that's how we become mindful of. That's what we become mindful of. Remaining mindful of the breath. Breathe in and breathe out. Mindful of the breath, long or short, breathe in and breathe out. What the Buddha is saying, there's a whole meditation practice of breathing in for a set period of time. Sometimes it's a whole meditation session to have these exaggerated long breaths because of this instruction. It's taken as the Buddha's teaching us that in order to meditate, we must have long breaths and then do short breaths. Well, the Buddha doesn't say that. Mindful of the breath, long or short, breathe in and breathe out. Don't manipulate the breath in any way. Training yourself to be sensitive to the breath. What does that mean, to training yourself to be sensitive to the breath? Instead of just taking it for granted, which we do as human beings, most people don't think about their breath too much, unless they're having trouble with it. The Buddha's teaching to make it the primary focus. Train yourself to be sensitive to the breath. In meditation. Train yourself to be sensitive to the breath and calming any bodily fabrication. What does it mean? It doesn't mean that I use meditation to resolve pain. And you might be thinking of Jon Kabat-Zinn. That's a technique that is specifically designed to use mindfulness in a way that addresses pain in the body, and it works great for that. That's not what this is. What the Buddha's teaching is if you notice any sensation in the body, any pain at all, here or there, notice he doesn't say breathe into your pain. New folks haven't heard me say this yet, but guess what? You can only breathe into your lungs. You can't breathe into any other part of your body. If you've got a pain in your foot and you want to breathe there and it helps you, go ahead. But if there's anything that's more of a fabrication than that, I can't imagine. Simply because we can't breathe in. And so the solution to pain is not to find a place where I can breathe into my foot. The solution to my contribution to pain and suffering is the Eightfold Path. And if I'm taught a meditation practice that if I have pain in my body to breathe into the pain, what am I doing? I'm not deepening my concentration, and all that I'm doing is focused on my feeling rather than letting it go. I'm going to go back to that one sentence. Training yourself to be sensitive to the breath and calming any bodily fabrication, anything that arises. Come back to the breath. And the act of coming back to the breath is what calms bodily fabrications. Ever mindful, calming the body with each breath, with each in-breath and each out-breath. Remaining mindful of the breath in the body, mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath, the arising and passing away of phenomena with regard to the body. The in-breath and the out-breath is both a practical experience of impermanence and a metaphor for impermanence. Objects, phenomena arises, and everything disappears. Everything passes away. And as I'm mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath, both components, it's important, not just the in-breath. As I'm mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath, I'm engaged in the whole entire cycle of life. The birth and the death, the arising and the passing away. And each proper breath, in-breath and out-breath, as I'm talking about as one breath, is both a metaphorical and a practical example of our entire life. And all of our encounters with phenomena. You can't think of anything, any phenomena you've attached yourself to over the course of your life that either came into existence and blinked out of existence while you were holding on to it, or you know that it will, such as your brand new house or brand new car, or it might be your brand old house and brand old car like mine. All of it is impermanent. None of it is me. Why would I want to attach myself to it? What I'm learning in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness is to first be dispassionate about what's occurring within me, and keep deepening my concentration so that off my cushion I can carry that with me and remain dispassionate. Another word for dispassionate is simply well concentrated. The Buddha says, in this way, one remains mindful internally and externally with regard to the body. What is the Buddha talking about internally and externally? It both refers to just our connection to the world even while we're being quiet in meditation, but also that external, the attempt to project a individual self, me, out into the world, internally and externally. I'm dealing with this on both of those levels, on the internal quiet level, the level within, but also the way that I project myself externally. With no self-reference, calmly noting there is a body, and remaining independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. What is that teaching? What is that about? Noting there is a body, but doing it dispassionately.
Not getting attached.
Not getting attached. It's just a body. And when we understand it from the point of view of the six properties, it's obvious. It's just a body.
I know. Help.
Oh, yeah.
Not becoming enamored by it.
And are you talking about the contemplation on the charnel grounds? That.
Yeah, and just every, I used to listen to Lanzaro, and he starts with a 30-minute, and I think it's all about calming, so then you can get into the concentration. I understand that's, but it did help. And it kind of goes back to the conversation yesterday that John asked, what should I read? And I feel like I wanted to read everything so then I can come back to you, because I buy into what you're saying and understand the distraction, but there was usefulness in all that.
Yeah. Not yet knowing what it isn't and just seeing it.
I didn't know what I didn't know until I listened to it.
And yeah, well,
it was a little bit off, and I understood that.
Oh, I didn't want to give the impression that you should never read anything that you might be interested in, whether it's Buddhist based or not. I didn't mean that. And David's right that you could read some books on Tibetan Buddhism, which won't have any relation at all to what we're teaching here, but you might gain some interest, insight into why the Buddha taught what he taught by understanding why they might teach what they taught because of fabricated views. So there's some usefulness to that. The a body scan is useful. Yoga Nidra is another one that is, it's all out there. Anybody can listen, download Yoga Nidra and do it. And it is, it's very relaxing. It's very calming. It's just not a concentration practice. So if you find that it's useful to do, do it. Just be clear in your mind that this is not my concentration practice. This is what I'm doing to prepare myself for meditation. Qigong, I think, is the best introduction to meditation out there. So learn what you do here and incorporate that. But also understand, Matt would agree, it's not your meditation practice, but it does support it, doesn't it? Was there a hand with Chris?
In the Vipassana as taught by S.N. Goenka scene, they teach the body scanning awareness in the initial 10-day course, and then when you eventually go into the longer course, like a 30-day course, the instructions are almost, so far, almost exactly as are yours. So they're pretty close. There might be something off in there. I don't know what it is, because I don't know.
Yeah.
But they're, that whole thing of, they're giving this body scanning thing in addition to the breath awareness anapana practice so that people have something to do while they're, so that there's something to do with the mind as a way of helping to calm it. And then as you progress in practice, that is set aside.
Yeah, you just said it right there, Chris.
Set aside because that in and of itself is an effort that's distracting from further absorption.
Yeah, it is.
The deepening of awareness, yeah.
And so,
and that instruction, I wish it was given earlier because you have to get to a 30-day course to get the instructions that are similar to what you're giving. And for some people, that's unfortunate. And for most people, they just designed it so the masses who are coming there for free would be getting the instruction.
Yeah, again, it's
really
it's
a
just
trip,
a, it,
know,
it's anyway. A, it, it, and even by your description, you can see that it's a, it is a different practice completely, even in the way that it's introduced to people. The Buddha didn't teach anything in that, and I
don't think so.
And
the Satipatthana Sutra.
No, what I'm saying is the sequencing. That you're teaching something to keep people interested. Do a body scan because you're not ready to do Samatha Vipassana meditation. That I don't want to get into a discussion about whether it's right or wrong. It's just not something the Buddha taught, and I see that he didn't teach it for a very specific reason.
Yeah, they end up where so far with what you're sharing so far.
Yeah. So what I teach is. I'm not trying to string people along, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Till they get to they're ready to awaken. And the only reason I say that is because that's not how the Buddha taught. The Buddha said start meditating. And again, I might get into it a little bit later in the sutta. But again, Chris, I'm not putting down the insight movement. I know an awful lot about it. I've been on many 7-day and 10-day Vipassana retreats. It just wasn't for me. And I also understand where it came from and its roots. And that's quite different than, well.
You know, just the Vipassana as taught by S.M. Goenka is very, very different from Spirit Rock.
Oh, it is. I agree.
So.
But even in the way that he teaches it, that's the way he teaches. He's, you know,
well,
free to do it. It's quite different. And the results, I think. Pardon me?
It's a brutal aesthetic.
Oh, it is. It's awful.
Yeah,
I was so ecstatic when they were over. That was all. And honestly. So, and I think that's why the Buddha didn't teach meditation like that or any type of body scanning. And again, I'm not saying if you find body scanning helpful, go ahead and do it. But also understand it's not something that the Buddha taught. I missed my space here. Okay, and now this next reflects on the modern walking meditation movement. And again, there's nothing wrong with thinking that you're going to meditate when you walk. It's simply not something that the Buddha taught, because there's an aspect of quieting the body that supports quieting the mind. What the Buddha taught was that when you're walking, you should be mindful that you're walking, but he didn't teach it as a meditation practice. And again, that's important. It's much easier to deepen concentration while I'm sitting here rather than walking around a nice, you know, no matter how mindful I am of my breath, I'm going to deepen my concentration here rather than out there. Make it a focused practice. The Buddha says, when walking, be mindful of walking. When standing, be mindful of standing. Again, look at the context. He's simply saying, no matter how you find yourself, that's how you should be mindful. While sitting, be mindful of sitting. While lying down, be mindful of lying down. In any function, be mindful that there is a body, no matter what I'm doing. Not there is my body, there is a body. When going about, looking this way and that, be fully mindful. It sounds almost like a childish instruction. But he also understood, he noticed people his whole life doing this, but never this. They were always here, there, and everywhere else, but never here. When looking here, there, or anywhere else, be fully mindful. When bending or reaching, be fully mindful. When carrying a bowl or a cloak, be fully mindful. When eating, drinking, savoring food, be fully mindful. When eliminating waste, be fully mindful. When walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, walking, talking, or being silent, be fully mindful. Notice there's no distinction or specialness placed on any of this, beginning with walking. Be in your body, know that there is a body. The whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma is to finally unite a mind in its body. In this way, one remains mindful of the breath in the body, the in-breath and the out-breath. In this way, one remains mindful of the breath in the body, the arising and the passing away of the body, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. There's nothing provoking this body. It's just a body. Just as a person with good eyesight, emptying a bag full of mixed grains, who knows, this is wheat, this is rice, these are beans, these are sesame seeds. In this same way, one remains mindful from the soles of the feet to the top of the head, encased in skin. There is hair, nails, teeth, tendons, bones, marrow, organs, feces, phlegm, blood, urine, sweat, fat, tears, saliva, mucus, and fluid in the joints. Why did the Buddha go through that long, elaborate list? He's trying to show that this thing that we're so enamored with, there's not really a good reason to be enamored with it. It's full of this stuff that's kind of icky. Why are we so enamored with it? Why are we so attached to it? It's just this. In this way, one remains mindful of the four elements because they're reflected in all of that. The earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the wind element. There's no me in any of those elements, is there? There's no me in the earth element, is there? Or the fire, or the water, or even the space element. Even in the consciousness property, there's no me in it, is there? That's the practical application that the Buddha is hoping to teach us in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Once we've concentrated our minds to the point where we can simply see things as they are, there is a body. It's not my body. Be mindful of the impermanence of the body to develop dispassion. We don't want to face that. It goes right back to the first teaching on the Eightfold, on suffering, sickness, aging, and death. Be mindful of it. It's not something we should avoid. Just like he taught Bahia, be mindful that this body is aging. The cow's going to get us at some time. It might be in the next moment. I better take to the Dhamma. That's the most important thing. Be mindful of the impermanence of the body to develop dispassion. If left unattended, a corpse decays quickly. It becomes bloated and infested. It is picked at by birds and dogs and other creatures. Eventually, nothing is left but dust. That's the line where people have created, and other mentions here, of creating the meditation on the charnel grounds. They've taken this description where the Buddha is using to teach impermanence to become its own meditation practice. Where all of that doing is reinforcing those fabricated views. Just be mindful that this body is impermanent and it's full of this stuff. Be mindful that this very body will die and pass away. This is the nature of the world and an unavailable fate, an unavoidable fate. An awakened human being is emphasizing this point. You're going to die. He didn't say, don't worry, it's going to take a while. He just said, you're going to die. What's important to you? In this way, one remains mindful of the breath in the body, the in-breath and the out-breath. In this way, one remains mindful of the arising and the passing away of the body, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. The Buddha is not teaching some kind of pleasantly conceptual way to talk about impermanence, like putting a flower in front of us and watch it wilt. He's hitting us between the eyes. He's saying, you know that thing that you're so enamored with? It's full of feces and phlegm and all this other stuff, and it's impermanent. It's not going to be yours forever. This is how one remains mindful of the breath in the body. Most people don't want to do that, especially initially. We really spend our whole lives knowing that we're going to die, but we don't want to face it. What's that called? Ignorance. Or ignoring the fact that we are going to become sick, we're going to age, we're going to die. We're going to be disappointed in life at times. By uniting the mind and the body and then looking at the body clearly and accurately, then I know that this thing that I'm inhabiting is truly impermanent. And it is an important aspect of impermanence is uncertainty. Because all things are impermanent, we never know how things are going to play out or how long they'll be around. Everything is uncertain, including our very next breath. Now, we shouldn't become overly fixated that I'm going to like be Bahia. He went a little bit too far. But not all that too far. We should have that type of enthusiasm for the Dhamma. And again, that's what the Buddha is trying to teach us in this sutta, in the Anapanasati Sutta too, Sati Sutta. This is how one remains mindful of the breath in the body. This is now called mindfulness of feelings. That was mindfulness of the breath in the body, mindfulness of feelings. And how does one remain mindful of feelings in and of themselves? When feeling pain, be mindful there is pain. Notice the Buddha doesn't say when you feel pain, you better do something to take care of it and get rid of it. He didn't even see it as a hindrance to awakening, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. He also didn't say you better find a drink or a drug to take it away, or some other distraction. When feeling pain, be mindful there is pain. Not there is my pain. That's joining with the pain. Just be mindful there is pain. I have an inflammatory condition and I do have a fair amount of pain in my body, except when I meditate. Almost always. Every now and then I'll get a twinge of something. But my most comfortable state is just like this. And I think because over the years I've trained myself that when I sit and I do this, my mind just becomes concentrated. So it's a less than concentrated mind that in me that my pain is affecting me to its greatest extent. When I have control of my mind, I have control of my pain. And again, it doesn't mean that you'll never have pain either. The Mahanibbana Sutta, the sutta about the last days of the Buddha died from food poisoning. And it's very descriptive about the level of pain that he has in his body. But he doesn't take it personal. There's the significant difference. When feeling pleasure, be mindful there is pleasure. So we treat pleasure just as we treat pain, which is dispassionately, isn't it? The Buddha's not saying when you feel pleasure, rejoice in your pleasure. Rejoice in your bliss. Embrace your pleasure. Embrace your bliss. We treat pleasure just like we treat pain. Which then allows, some people's thoughts will be, what do you mean? I'm not supposed to enjoy myself? I'm just supposed to suffer? That's not what the Buddha's saying, is it? He's saying it's all the same thing. He's saying there's going to be suffering, there's going to be pain, there's going to be pleasure. Don't make it personal and enjoy the ride. Meaning enjoy the pain too, because it's all part of your life. When I insist that I cannot have pain, that I don't deserve it, I should be above it, or this body shouldn't have pain, I'm telling myself that you can't have a life. Because pain is part of life, isn't it? And if I insist that I shouldn't have pain, I'm insisting that I shouldn't have a life. And I'll create incredible scenarios, including crawling down huge bottles of vodka to make sure that I won't have any pain. And some of us know from that experiment that it just gets worse. It is funny, but I'm not trying to be funny. It is funny because it's so absurd, isn't it? The things it will do so that we don't feel. When the Buddha says what to do with, what should we do with our feelings? I don't have to do anything with them. I can feel pain, it's just pain. I can feel pleasure, it's just pleasure. I don't have to create a fabricated view and want more or less of it. And if I'm free of fabrications, if I'm free of ignorance, I won't. My mind simply won't go there. When feeling neither pleasure nor pain, meaning ambivalence, and this is how most of us live our lives, is in this ambivalent, ambiguous state. When feeling neither pleasure nor pain, be mindful that there's neither pleasure nor pain, instead of ignoring even that. And what happens from a mind that's constantly seeking distraction and sensual fulfillment and it's not occurring, it becomes a very dull kind of existence, doesn't it? And so we start seeking something to distract us, something to come into this moment that is not doing anything for me. The Buddha is saying, be mindful of that and don't change it. Well, he doesn't say it, but he said, being mindful of it means simple acceptance of it. Remember, it's the difference between approval and acceptance. So I find myself with neither pleasure nor pain, this ambiguous state. And rather reacting to it, thinking, well, what the hell happened to me? Where am I in this? What am I getting out of this moment in my life? I'm at peace with it. Because it's just like every other moment in my life. It's just like pain, and it's just like those pleasurable moments. It just is. It's just life. And in that way, by being mindful of pain is just pain and pleasure is just pleasure, and neither pleasure nor pain or ambivalence is just that. And I don't need it to be any different. So I can just stay present for it all. And on our cushions, that's the beginning of training for that. When feeling the pain of the body, be mindful there is pain of the body. When feeling pain not of the body, meaning a mental disturbance, be mindful that there is pain not of the body. And again, Buddha's not saying to analyze it or figure it out. Just be mindful there it is. When feeling pleasure in the body, be mindful there is pleasure in the body. When feeling pleasure not in the body and a pleasurable excitement in the mind, be mindful that there is pleasure that's not in the body. When feeling neither pleasure nor pain in the body, be mindful that there is neither pleasure nor pain in the body. When feeling neither pleasure nor pain not in the body, be mindful that there is neither pleasure nor pain not in the body. In this way, one remains mindful of feelings arising and passing away, and independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. Again, this whole sutta is painting this picture of dispassion. It's just the arising and passing away, while I am not clinging to anything in the world. Now, this initially is established in meditation. I've just interrupted my clinging to the world in that moment. Off our cushion, we maintain that level of seclusion and remain free of being entangled in the world. But it's established in right meditation. And the Buddha says, in this way, one remains mindful internally and externally with regards to feelings. This is how one remains mindful of feelings in and of themselves. On to thoughts. There is a lot of commentary in this sutta, and I encourage you to read it, but I'm not going to. And how does one remain mindful of thoughts in and of themselves? When thoughts are passionate, be mindful that thoughts are passionate. When thoughts are dispassionate, be mindful that thoughts are dispassionate. Simple instructions. When there are thoughts of aversion, be mindful that there are thoughts of aversion. Notice that Buddha doesn't say if you find yourself in aversion, if you find yourself hating someone, you better start hating yourself first. He just says notice it. Notice what's occurring. And there's the reason why analyzing it in any way isn't helpful, because that's just furthering the underlying I-making that brought that to the fore. Is that clear? Yeah. Is it yes? You understand that, why there's no value? Just recognizing this is where my mind is at the moment and come back to what's actually occurring. When thoughts are free of aversion, be mindful that thoughts are free of aversion. It's good to continue to reinforce ourselves as our minds become more calm, more well concentrated, to let ourselves know that, to think about that. Wow, my mind is much more clear, much more calm than it ever was. Don't take too much credit for it and come back to the sensation of breathing. When thoughts are diluted, but it is important to take take the proper amount of credit for what we're doing. It's just as important to recognize the Dhamma progressing as it is to recognize where we still need some work. Those are both important components of the Dhamma. When thoughts are free of delusion, be mindful that thoughts are free of delusion. I mentioned this to Larry earlier. There's a famous sutta that I don't think I'll get to called the Vitaka Santana Sutta. And in that sutta, the Buddha teaches, and I think it's a concluding line, that we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. Meaning each and every thought is appropriate to what's occurring. There's no me in it. There's no I making in it. And that's what the Buddha's talking about. When thoughts are free of delusion, be mindful that thoughts are free of delusion. Knowing that, it's not something we have to guess at. And we know it because we have the framework to see it. How would a deluded mind know that it's not deluded anymore unless it had a framework? Or else it's just deluding itself, isn't it? How would we know? We know because we have something to measure it against. It's this structure of the Eightfold Path. And it's also a well-concentrated mind. Now, as we start meditating, even John, you were mentioning earlier today, you notice a difference in your meditation. It doesn't take all that much to develop enough concentration to notice that difference. Picture of my dog. I didn't even look at the restraint I just practiced. Morris sent me a picture of Bodhi and I didn't look at it, but I almost did. Can you give me a minute? When thoughts are free of delusion, be mindful that thoughts are free of delusion and free of Bodhi. When the mind is constricted, be mindful that the mind is constricted. What a beautiful line. I didn't realize how constricted my mind was, and yet I was right about everything. I knew everything there was to know at one point in my life. I just didn't realize how constricting that was, to have to be a person that knew everything. It's awful. The Buddha would often refer to his life prior to his awakening as his whole life was a life of constriction. Even living in a palace, in his father's palace, having everything any kid could ever want, it was constricted to him. Why? Because his experience of life was constricted by his view. This is a view. We talk about spaciousness. Anybody that gets into the meditation movement talks about spaciousness at some point. This is true spaciousness. Spaciousness. It's letting go of those narrow, fabricated views and being open and present for everything in a very mindful way. When the mind is constricted, be mindful that the mind is constricted. When thoughts are scattered, be mindful that thoughts are scattered. It's okay to recognize that you have monkey mind, especially now because we have a solution. When the mind is spacious, be mindful the mind is spacious. When thoughts are common, be mindful that thoughts are common. When thoughts are unsurpassed, be mindful that thoughts are unsurpassed. And not be too passionate about either one. Not be passionate at all. When the mind is not concentrated, be mindful the mind is not concentrated. When the mind is concentrated, be mindful that the mind is concentrated. Mom, would you give me a little... Straight up, not on the rocks. I'll let Ron sit down. Thank you, sir. Holy water. I'm sorry. I don't mean to get so silly. Sometimes I just do. When the mind is not concentrated, be mindful the mind is not concentrated. When the mind is concentrated, be mindful that the mind is concentrated. It's a simple, direct instructions, isn't it? But it's important to be mindful when our minds are developing concentration. When the mind is not released, be mindful the mind is not released. When the mind is released, be mindful the mind is released. How else would we know unless we're mindful of it? In this way, one remains mindful internally and externally with regards to thoughts. Next, the quality of mind. mindfulness of the present quality of mind. And how does one remain mindful of the present quality of mind in and of itself? One remains focused on the mind internally, externally, on the mind itself. It's just that. Whatever is occurring, that's how we do it. How does your mind feel right now? What's the quality of your mind? You don't have to answer it. Just acknowledge that that's what it is. That's being mindful of your mind. Be at peace with however you find your mind. If your mind is outside there and you can't wait to get to a walk, be mindful of that. It's okay. It's what you're thinking about. If you're thinking, when is that crazy old bald guy going to shut up? That's what you're thinking about. And it's your thought. But using that as an example, that would be an inappropriate thought right now, wouldn't it? Not because of me, but because you're here to learn the Dhamma. You're distracted in that moment by what you're focusing on. Is that clear? Yeah. Maybe that was a silly example. One remains focused on the mind internally, externally, or the mind itself. One remains focused on the origination of the mind and the arising and passing away. This is going to be a good one. Good test. What's the origination of the mind in this context that the Buddha's talking about? It's not a creator God, just a hint. The origination of the mind. Why do we have to deal with these four foundations of mindfulness?
A mind rooted in ignorance.
A mind that's not rooted in ignorance doesn't need to deal with it, does it? But a mind that is has to be remain focused on that to know it. Has to be back in its place. There's the structure of the Eightfold Path in a right meditation practice. It brings us back into our body where fabrications are arising and passing away. That's the only point that the Dhamma can be effective, isn't it? We make our preparations and we do things and we hear things over and over again. So as our understanding builds, it may seem like tomorrow is a day that I'll awaken, but you won't. When you awaken, it's going to be now. It just might not be this now. I'm not trying to be cute there. Do you understand that? If I'm constantly doing things with the hope that at some point I'm going to awaken, we miss the whole point of taking true refuge in the Buddha's Dhamma. Because I know that an awakened human being did this. He left me his teaching and we're fortunate to have a well-focused Sangha. I know that I've been given everything I need to awaken. John, all that I have to do is this. Yes.
Is that like you said before, the Eightfold Path is fabricated, but when awakening occurs, there is no more Eightfold Path. It's just what it is.
Yeah. And so it's a good point. So my thoughts prior to, let me use Siddhartha G. The Buddha, when he was Siddhartha, prior to his awakening, his thoughts were fabricated, weren't they? And yet he developed internally an Eightfold Path, a fabricated path, and that's even another good example of it. It came from the Buddha in response to his fabricated mind. So he still used those thoughts that were once fabricated to help himself out of that fabricated state. So I don't think I'm explaining that well. The problem of a fabricated mind isn't that I have to find a way to... It's going to be tough to explain this.
You're unaware.
Yes, awakening occurs within a fabricated mind is what I'm trying to say. I had so much trouble saying. And so the Eightfold Path is a path to use within a fabricated mind, and so it's fabricated just by definition, to recognize and abandon fabricated views. It's another way of saying, and you hear me say this often, when we want to communicate really meaningful with people, we have to meet them where they are. A simple explanation would be if I meet an Indian person and I don't know Indian, I just say English, I'm not meeting them where they are. It's a useless, no matter how much compassion I might have, I'm not meeting that person where they are. And again, it's a silly example. In that case, I would say, I'm sorry, I can't teach you. But if I want to be present with people, if I really care about people, I have to be mindfully present with them. If I really care about myself, the same applies. I have to be mindfully present for myself. I can't keep living this fantasy, this fabricated way of looking at the world. And again, that's what the Buddha is teaching here. To let go of all of this passionate passionate thoughts that arise from feelings and thoughts and being enamored with my thoughts and where my body's going, and just see it plainly, see it dispassionately. It's just feelings, it's just thoughts, it's just consciousness arising and passing away. Let me continue. One remains focused on the origination of the mind, the arising and the passing away with regard to the mind itself. The mind itself arises and passes away. It's just as impermanent as anything else. One knows there is a mind. It's not my mind, it's just a mind. And so now we're developing to the point where our ongoing thought process is simply a dispassionate reference to our own life, to life as life occurs. You gotta, you know, we're getting, you get into these little semantic problems like using that phrase, our life, well, whose life is it? But if you're, you need to get past that type of clinging, looking for a reason why it doesn't work. You can always find a way that it doesn't work. So at some point, language breaks down. And so I'm referring to an awakened self as opposed to an unawakened self. There seems to be a contradiction to those people, especially if you don't know the Dhamma. But you know that there isn't, is it? It's just an awakened self as opposed to an unawakened self. And an awakened self is a self that is free of any possible contributions to its own suffering. It doesn't mean that it won't age and die, but it won't create suffering for itself. That's the significant difference. One knows there is a mind. They remain independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. This is how one remains mindful of thoughts in and of themselves. Simply a mind. Be at peace with that mind, no matter what the present quality of your mind is. Through the four foundations, you'll develop the ability to remain dispassionate at peace, no matter what's occurring in your world or even in your mind. You will have the ability to be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state, which seems to be more and more important as time goes on today. It's a lot more less than peaceful mind states, it seems. Mindfulness of the five hindrances. So now the Buddha taught us how to develop concentration in meditation. Now the rest of this is how to apply that concentration to very specific themes of the Dhamma and within the framework of the Eightfold Path. The reason I'm saying that is the rest of this sutta is what many people have taken as continued instructions for meditation, meaning you should meditate on this and that and these other things, when that's not the case. Now, this is called mindfulness of the five hindrances. Remain mindful of the quality of the mind in reference to the five hindrances. Not analyze it, not create them, just be mindful of them. When sensual, and I'll explain what they are to those who are not referencing right now. When sensual desire, the first hindrance, is present, be mindful that sensual desire is present. So that's a primary theme of the Dhamma, isn't it? Noticing and abandoning sensual desire. But if we notice that I'm full of sensual desire, I can't wait to get that next plate of bibimbap, and it's distracting me, what does the Buddha tell me to do? He doesn't tell me to beat myself up over it or think that my Dhamma practice is useless. He simply says, come back to the breath. Notice it. When sensual desire is present, be mindful that sensual desire is present. But also, he's not saying to act on it, where some people would say, in fact, there's even a philosophy of taking as much as we possibly can. Yeah. I mean, it's a real philosophy. the thinking behind that is we only get, it has to do with a nihilistic and humanistic way of looking at the world and combining those two, that since I only have one life to live, and it's going to come to an end, maybe in the next moment, I might as well just grab everything I can. And anybody, you can live your life that way if you want. You're not likely to gain any understanding, though. I'd rather have the understanding than all the stuff in the world. When sensual desire is not present, be mindful that sensual desire is not present. It's as important to know both sides of that. Be mindful of abandoning sensual desire when it arises. That's the ruts, the Dhamma hitting the present moment, the rubber hitting the road. When sensual desire is present, now I practice the Dhamma with wise restraint. Everybody understands what that means?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And if you seem to be struggling with that, just remind yourself that this thing that's distracting me out of my body right now is not me. It's not mine. It's not who I am. And sometimes you'll have to do that repeatedly. But the key is to treat it dispassionately. The fact that you have to do it should be a source of inspiration, because you have a way of dealing with it that works. Rather than being frustrated with, oh, here it is again, be grateful that your Dhamma practice is working, or you wouldn't even notice it. Is that clear? And that is important. That's part of right effort, to understand that this is really working, even at times. And every one of you that has taken to the Dhamma has felt, just to use the word, a negative impact from the Dhamma at times, haven't you? That it seems overwhelming, that you seem like you just can't face this anymore. What you're doing is facing fabrications. You take a breath and you come back to what's occurring, because it's like foam on the water. There's nothing really there, including these hindrances. When ill will is present, the second hindrance, when ill will is present, be mindful that ill will is present. When ill will is not present, be mindful that ill will is not present. Be mindful of abandoning ill will when it arises. It's a direct conscious act. When it arises. Be mindful that when ill will has been completely abandoned, ill will not arise in the future. When laziness and drowsiness is present, be mindful that laziness and drowsiness is present. When laziness and drowsiness is not present, be mindful that laziness and drowsiness is not present. Excuse me. And that's the instruction that the Buddha's given to all of these hindrances. Just be dispassionate. Just be mindful that they're aware that they're there. Don't wish them away. Just be present with them and take a breath. Be mindful that when laziness and drowsiness has been completely abandoned, laziness and drowsiness will not arise in the future. When restlessness and anxiety is present, be mindful that restlessness and anxiety is present. When restlessness and anxiety is not present, be mindful that restlessness and anxiety is not present. Be mindful of the abandoning of restlessness and anxiety when it arises. So as we start developing mindfulness and we feel ourselves getting restless, full of worry and anxiety, be mindful that it's arising and come back to the sensation of breathing. And for those of us that have been suffering from anxiety, I think I've mentioned, I was on all kinds of medication for social anxiety disorder, and I literally got off the medication from a meditation practice. I'm not, everybody out there, listen, I'm not saying you should do it, but that was possible in my case. Be mindful that when restless anxiety has been completely abandoned, restlessness and anxiety will not arise in the future. When doubt and uncertainty are present, be mindful that doubt and uncertainty is present. When doubt and uncertainty is not present, be mindful that doubt and uncertainty is not present. Again, one of the most big part of the Zen schools, particularly the Chinese school, talk about embracing our doubt and cultivating doubt. Cultivate that great doubt. It's a good idea, maybe, but it's not something the Buddha taught. It's just a distraction at that point, isn't it? If you want to be a Zen practitioner that cultivates doubt, that's what you do. If you want to be a Dhamma practitioner and you recognize doubt or its cousin uncertainty, what do? You don't cultivate it. You come back to the sensation of breathing. You treat it like anything else, any other phenomenon, in an impersonal way. Be mindful that when doubt and uncertainty has been completely abandoned, doubt and uncertainty will not arise in the future. The Buddha has given us some promises that if you would just do this, you can count on this. You can count on actually developing the Dhamma to the point where you maintain a calm and peaceful mind no matter what's occurring.
You can turn that feeling of doubt into investigating Dhamma.
That's covered by right effort.
Yeah, I found out because I'm a pretty doubtful person, and I found that's how I managed to turn it. And I wouldn't say using the doubt, but using that energy that comes up and investigating what I'm doubtful about.
Yes, but you're using the framework of the Eightfold Path to investigate it. What that term, embracing your doubt or cultivate your doubt, it's just a conceptual application of something to do with your mind. And I don't want to get too deep into that.
Isn't he cultivating the seven factors?
Well, yeah, but that's something, that type of practice is something different than this. And the idea the idea is that you put so much, I don't know, has anybody been to a true Zen monastery and meditated with them?
Sure.
You'll notice that some of the severe, they're not severe, the advanced people, they'll almost be sweating in their intensity. In fact, I've seen this. And they're so intense on what they're doing that they're sweating and some people are shaking. It's because of that intense mental focus on trying to, it's taught that you, if you meditate hard enough, long enough, with enough focus, eventually your mind will kind of explode into awakening out of that agony, out of that, that intense focus. And that's part of the understanding of this, this intense look at doubt. And eventually, again, your mind will explode into awakening. Maybe. But it never happened to me, and I tried it for a long time. Again, I don't, it is absurd. I think it's absurd looking at it from my point of view that I did it. But it's a common practice, and it should be respected, except it's not what? In this way, one remains mindful of the quality of mind and the arising and the passing away of the qualities of mind, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. Again, there's that line. It's just, this is what's occurring and nothing else. It's not attached to anything else. This is how one remains mindful of the quality of mind in and of itself. Mindfulness of the five clinging aggregates. So the Buddha's taught us to develop concentration and start incorporating this refined mindfulness and then apply it first to the hindrances, then to these five clinging aggregates. Furthermore, one remains mindful of the quality of mind in reference to the five clinging aggregates. The five clinging aggregates are form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness. Again, that consciousness rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Those are the, and if you look at yourself and any one or all of those aggregates, those are the things that you use to describe yourself and define your life. To describe yourself to, your, to yourself and the world around you and actually describe your life. On this form, on this way that I view the world, my perceptions, and as those perceptions crystallize and harden, they become a fabrication, and then that fabrication forms my way of thinking. Do you see how all five clinging aggregates are present in the mind rooted in ignorance? Do you see that? That's important. And so the five clinging aggregates are simply the description of the ongoing personal experience of suffering, ongoing personal experience of a mind rooted in ignorance. Furthermore, one remains mindful of the quality of mind in reference to these five clinging aggregates. Remain mindful of form and the arising and passing away of form. So now he's telling us, be dispassionate about even this something that is this personal. When you're clinging to form, be mindful that you're clinging to form and let it go. It's just form. Remain mindful of feelings and the arising and passing away of feelings, taking us right back to the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta. Remain mindful of perceptions and the arising and the passing away of perceptions. Remain mindful of fabrications and the arising and passing away of fabrications. Remain mindful of consciousness and the arising and passing away of consciousness. Again, just notice that your thoughts are always coming and going. It's when we attach ourselves to our thoughts and become enamored with our thoughts that then our own thoughts are starting to work against us. They're just thoughts. And there's nothing personal about those thoughts. Matt does a good example of this when he teaches that the heart in the body pumps blood through the body just impersonally. It doesn't need me to think about. Why don't you say this? Because you explain it better than I do.
Just how Anatta co-opts our senses as well as all of the involuntary processes of the body. The heart pumping blood.
All right. All right, turn this off.
My eyes are closed. I open my eyes. The phenomenon of vision is then co-opted by Anatta and becomes what I see, what I want to see, what my preferences are based on eye consciousness. The vision itself doesn't require me. Hearing doesn't require me. All of these things, breathing, doesn't require me. These are just processes that the body naturally does that have nothing to do with Matt or Joey Z or whoever else. It's just what occurs without any personalization, anything attached to it.
Thank you. Does everybody understand what Matt said? Mm-hmm. I mean, he's pretty clear about it. He was actually very clear on that one point, that I use my senses to establish myself in the world because I think this is me. And so I interpret everything from that point of view, don't I? I can't help but doing that. And that's just how a human being operates. There's that saying, garbage in, garbage out. Mindfulness in, then useful mindfulness in, what we should hold in mind in, then we can express it into the world. But it's just that way. What we hold in mind is going to determine what we experience. And if we hold in mind a fabricated view of life, all that we can hope to experience is that fabricated view. Remain mindful of consciousness in the arising and passing away of consciousness. In this way, one remains mindful of the five clinging aggregates and the arising and passing away of the five clinging aggregates, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. This is how one remains mindful of the five clinging aggregates rather than being affected by the five clinging aggregates. It's just what's occurring. It's just what's operating in my life right now. Be mindful of it. Mindfulness of the sixth sense base. Furthermore, one remains mindful of the quality of mind in and of itself in reference to the sixth sense base. Just like Matt was saying, my senses are completely impersonal unless I make them personal. Unless I insist on hearing something a certain way or not hearing something at all ever, or smelling certain sounds or tasting certain tastes or anything else for that matter. When I take the I out of that, then I'm simply present for life as life occurs, and then everything is meaningful. I keep saying that. But we diminish our experience of our own life by personalizing it. It sounds like a paradox, but it's just that way. By me insisting that this is me and this is mine, I've taken away the underlying true nature of it, because it's not me or mine, and I'm missing out on my life. That's the underlying stress. Remain mindful of the I form and the clinging that arises to the I form. Be mindful of the arising of clinging to I form, and be mindful that when clinging to the I form is completely abandoned, clinging to the I form will not arise in the future. And I'm going to skip over a little bit. The Buddha just relates that way to all the other senses. Although I do want to say the last. I can't.
We don't need it. Five paragraphs down from what you just read.
What?
In this way, one remains mindful of the sixth sense base.
Oh, yes. Thank you. In this way, one remains mindful of the sixth sense base, the arising and the passing away of the sixth sense base, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. This is how one remains mindful of the sixth sense base. In other words, we treat the sixth sense base as thing that is so special, and it is in one way. It's how we relate to the world, but at that level, it is completely impersonal. But it is at that level that I making occurs or awakening occurs. That's really the point that I want to make there. Mindfulness of the seven factors of awakening. Now again, this is instruction for what to be mindful of, not what to do. Further, the each factor is what we're doing. The mindfulness of it is just instructions on to do that. Furthermore, one remains mindful of the quality of mind in reference to the seven factors of awakening. Remain mindful that mindfulness is a factor of awakening within me. If mindfulness as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful that mindfulness as a factor of awakening is not present. And be mindful of how mindfulness as a factor of awakening will arise. How will it arise? Through Dhamma practice, through the Eightfold Path. Remain mindful of the culmination of the development of mindfulness as a factor of awakening. Meaning, again, noticing continually how our Dhamma practice is developing. It's important to do that. Remain mindful that investigation of the Dhamma is a factor of awakening. John and I had a good talk about that. It's not just meditation. It's investigation of the Dhamma, meaning developing the Eightfold Path, but also reading and integrating these other supportive suttas too. Dhamma is If investigation of the Dhamma as a factor of awakening is not present, meaning you're simply not studying and being part of a Sangha, be mindful that investigation of the Dhamma is not present, and be mindful of how investigation of the Dhamma as a factor of awakening will arise. Obvious what that is. Remain mindful of the culmination of the development of the investigation of the Dhamma as a factor of awakening. Again, these are to be taken to their conclusion. Investigation of the Dhamma should be taken to its conclusion. Being mindful of mindfulness should be taken to its the conclusion is an awakened state of mind. Remain mindful that persistence is a factor of awakening. If persistence as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful that persistence is not present. I'm going to skip over a few of these sentences that are repetitive. Remain mindful that the culmination of the development of persistence as a factor of awakening. Remain mindful that joyful engagement with the Dhamma is a factor of awakening. If joyful engagement with the Dhamma as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful that joyful engagement with the Dhamma is not present, and be mindful to generate that. We should be joyful about the Dhamma, shouldn't we? I think so. Remain mindful that serenity or a calm and quiet mind is a factor of awakening. If serenity as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful and so cultivate it. Remain mindful of the culmination of the development of serenity as a factor of awakening. Be mindful that it's developing. Remain mindful that concentration is a factor of awakening. If concentration as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful that concentration is not present, and be mindful of how concentration as a factor of awakening will arise. How will concentration arise if it's not already present? Already present? Remain mindful of the culmination of the development of concentration as a factor of awakening. Remain mindful that equanimity is a factor of awakening. If equanimity as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful that equanimity is not present, and be mindful of how equanimity as a factor of awakening will arise. How will equanimity arise as a factor of awakening?
Practice.
Yes. In this way, one remains mindful of the seven factors of awakening and the arising and passing away of the seven factors of awakening, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. This is how one remains mindful of the seven factors of awakening in and of themselves. So again, we're not making a meditation practice or meditating on or contemplating any one of these. We're simply incorporating them into this mind that is deepening in concentration as a factor of awakening. They're not to be dismissed in any way. And finally, the Buddha teaches that we should be mindful of Four Noble Truths. Furthermore, one remains mindful of the quality of mind in reference to Four Noble Truths. Remain mindful of knowing that this is stress, this is the origination of stress, this is the cessation of stress, and this is the Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of stress. Tonight's talk is going to be on that Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, those are the four noble truths. Kevin had his hand up. In this way, one remains mindful of the quality of mind and of itself internally and externally. One remains mindful of the phenomena of the origination of the qualities of mind and their arising and passing away. There is the knowledge of the maintenance of the qualities of mind and their recollection, another word for mindfulness, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world, meaning no matter what's occurring in the world, we can continue to develop our Dhamma practice. In fact, we should, we must. This is how one remains mindful of the seven factors of awakening in and of themselves. The reason why I said that is that the world seems to be getting more and more tumultuous. And I noticed right after the last election, there were regulars that were so disturbed and distracted by the election that they did not feel comfortable anymore doing something that they felt was selfish at that point, developing the Dhamma. How can I do this? How can I do something that is so self-involved when there's all this suffering in the world? Of course, that's just another strategy to avoid your own responsibility for awakening, isn't it? Because an awakened human being can now at least have a positive effect on the world. Where was I? Now, the effectiveness of the four foundations of mindfulness. Why should we do it? Now, if anyone develops these four foundations of mindfulness in this manner for 7 years, just 7 years, one could expect complete understanding here and now. Or, if there is any clinging and maintaining remaining after 7 years in this present life. What a powerful declarative statement, isn't it? And it contradicts all the ideas that it takes endless eons. Anybody of you have been modern Buddhist practice, I've heard that. It takes endless eons to awaken, or that it's not even really possible, don't consider it. It's often taught today that human beings today are so devolved that the possibility of awakening isn't there anymore. But to me, they go ahead and practice anyway. Well, why would I? The Buddha obviously never said that. In fact, he encourages us. Remember the Bahia Sutta. He's encouraging us to do it, meaning accomplish this as quickly as possible, because we don't know. So the Buddha just said, if we do this wholeheartedly, the way he taught, in this present lifetime we'll awaken. But then he says, let alone 7 years, if anyone perfectly develops these four foundations of mindfulness in this manner, meaning simply the way that he taught, for 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, or 1 year, for 6 months, for 3 months, for 1 month, for 2 weeks, for 7 days, one could expect either complete understanding here and now, or if there is any clinging and maintaining after those 7 days, in this present lifetime. Mm-hmm. So another reason why we have retreats like this. Would you rather spend 3 or 4 days just in quiet, and that's nice, or would you rather start learning, engaging in one of those factors of the Dhamma, of awakening, investigation of the Dhamma? Because each moment that we are doing this, we are clearer, we are more clear as to what our practice should be each and every moment, and we're more well concentrated to keep bringing our Dhamma practice into the present moment, into life as life unfolds. Friends, this is the direct path for the purification of all beings, for the cessation of sorrow and regret, for the disappearance of pain and distress, for establishing the right method of practice, and for complete unbinding. Remember I asked you before if you wanted those things? This is how we do it. In other words, these four foundations of mindfulness. It all rests in jhana. Let me just skip ahead. I thought that was the end. This is what the Buddha said, and having heard those words, those assembled were gratified and delighted. That is, again, you can see it's singular importance, because hopefully we're using that every day in our meditation practice. And then the instruction that take this well-concentrated mind with the framework of the Eightfold Path and develop these seven factors of awakening, the Four Noble Truths, bring the hindrances into that, and the five clinging aggregates. And look at that, investigate it that way, not in some conceptual way, but in a direct and practical way. That's what the Buddha's teaching here. I think it's probably a little bit too late to go any further. How's everybody doing? Ready for a break or another quick sutta?
Ready for a break.
There it is. Okay, it's 10 after 4. I think dinner is 5:30, so we've got a little bit of time. Tonight we're going to look at the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and the Magavabhanga Sutta, the Buddha's first teaching on Four Noble Truths and then his analysis of the Eightfold Path. So everybody's doing well? I know you're eager to get out of here and just move around a little bit, but is there any questions? Okay, good. And always, you got anything, Larry?
Well, I'm developing here a really good understanding of this, and there's a lot of clarity that I'm feeling about it. But I just to cite one example, when there's doubt, recognize there's doubt. And, come back to the breathing.
Yep.
Just be mindful that there's doubt.
Yep, that's all.
But at some point, whatever I'm doubtful about needs to be resolved.
Not necessarily.
No, but if I go out that door to just make it as simple as possible, I do have a decision about going left and right.
Mm-hmm. I'm not making the connection to doubt, though.
Well, there is, we all hold doubt about things.
Oh, okay, good, great question. If I doubt that the Yankees are going to win the World Series this year, I can hold on to that doubt because it's meaningless. It's the type of existential doubt that drives us towards, it's a kind of doubt that I can't face the fact that I'm uncertain about where I'm going when I die. And so let me fabricate something out of that type of doubt. Because I don't have something to fill it. That's what we're talking about. It's doubt that will take you away from your Dhamma practice. Doubting whether I should turn left or right because I just don't have enough information it's important to, you brought up an important point, Larry, because we still have to live in the world, don't we? We still have to figure out to turn left or right constantly. But those are simple, mundane choices that are better made from a well-concentrated, calm, and peaceful mind than one that is distracted and agitated.
Mm-hmm. It's worthwhile really diving deep into these two mindfulness suttas.
Wait, say that again, Dave?
To really read them and understand what these words mean. Because it's simple to make that mistake about doubt or some of the other words. And that's where study, that's where investigation, that's where...
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the Buddha's referring, when we find ourselves in meditation and doubt arises, he's saying, just come back to your breath. Be dispassionate about it. Let doubt be doubt. It's not the time to do anything with it. Now is the time to meditate. And then off our cushions, we will take that same attitude. It doesn't mean that we'll be free, completely free of doubt. I doubt that. But it won't overwhelm us anymore. And as doubt keeps appearing in our... Doubt is still a function of, almost entirely, of a fabricated mind. Because it's a mind that is constantly grasping, that creates doubt. I'm not going to get what I want. What's going to happen? I doubt I'll get it. And uncertainty is simply a part of life. But as we accept it as a part of life, it's no longer an issue. So I might even make a game. I'm not sure if I should turn left or right, and I doubt it's left, but let me go that way just to see what happens. And I might do that with a peaceful and calm mind, rather than a mind that is rooted in eye-making, insisting that before I even make a move, I got to know where I'm going to end up. Mm-hmm. And that grips us all at one point or another. We have so much fear and uncertainty that we can't even get out of our home. There was a time in my life when I couldn't open my mail. I was so full of power. And this is when I was drinking and doing a lot of stuff. But it was a real fear. I thought that there was something really awful going to be in that envelope.
Yeah.
Or in the phone.
I was rereading Alice in Wonderland. and you know, there's this one point in the story that Lewis Carroll wrote where she arrives at the fork in the road, and there's this Cheshire cat with a shit-eating grin on its face sitting in the tree branch above her. And she looks at the cat and says, "Which way should I go?" And he said, "Where are you going?" And she said, "I don't know." And he said, "Then it doesn't make a difference."
That's right.
You know, I think that's, I'm hearing that's what you're saying here. You just go.
Yeah. And a mind rooted in fabrications insist on those answers before it moves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Again, doubt and uncertainty is simply part of having a human life. An ego-based self does not want that doubt. It needs to have those answers to itself. I need to know. You know, and we do all kinds of things and spend a lot of money to try and create certainty where there can't possibly be certainty.
John, doesn't that also address becoming? So when you're making that choice, when there's doubt and you're making that choice, the question is, do you want to move towards enlightenment or away from enlightenment?
Yes. Each every moment, that's the choice we have. I thought about introducing the Ratana Sutta to this retreat too. The Ratana Sutta is a sutta on the three refuges. The refuge of the Buddha, his Dhamma, and a well-focused Sangha. But I'm just going to give it anyway. I'm going to go all the whole thing. In that sutta, the Buddha is summoned to come to a town that was devastated by floods and diseases. He was in a nearby town, and so he goes to the town with some monks and nuns in tow. And he has the monks and nuns tend to the physical needs of the town folks, and then he gives them the Dhamma. And basically he says, when all of your physical needs are first taken care of, food, clothing, shelter, and medicine, then take to the Dhamma. He says, and there is no more perfect, no more perfect person to follow, let me put it that way, than the Buddha. The Buddha is describing himself. So you take refuge. And why should we take refuge? Refuge is a place of comfort and safety. Why should we take refuge in the Buddha? What does it mean? Should we worship him? Should we idolize him? Set him up as a god? No. There's no refuge in that, really, is there, if you think too much about it. I don't want to stretch that too far. We take refuge in the Buddha because he was a human being. And if a human being can awaken, it's safe to assume, it's comfortable to assume, I've taken refuge in the idea that I too can do it. Plus, he gave me his teachings on how to do it. I take refuge in that. And also, I'm fortunate to have a well-focused sangha. I have the three jewels, the three refuges. And I don't need anything else. And if I can keep it focused on that, on the Buddha, his Dhamma, and a well-focused sangha, then I'll get, or I'll develop, what he taught. But if I take one, two, or three of them out of it, what can I expect? I can't expect the Dhamma, can I? That's all that it is. That's all that this means. It's not being exclusionary or isolated in any way. It's just the way it is. And there's no... The reason why I said that is when you truly commit to refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, most of your doubt's going to fall away because you are now committed to it. And you're committed because of your own direct experience. Outside looking in, you have to get past that, though, don't you? And so you might enter the Dhamma with a fabricated view of and full of doubt and uncertainty, but as you continue in the Dhamma, it will fall away. I would hold myself out as an example that I'm pretty certain that the Dhamma is useful. You know, there's no doubt in my mind. And I would bet in most of your minds. And that's not to imply that if you have doubt, there's something wrong in your practice either. Just don't cultivate it.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.